Hello and welcome to Sunday Messages with Fairmount Friends Church. We're so glad that you are joining us. You can find out more on www.fairmountfriendschurch.org. We have a special training session with social worker Megan Stroop.
Thank you for coming tonight. I'm Megan's husband, Jake, and I just found out I was doing this a couple minutes ago. So it's probably not going to be as professional as what Megan is going to present to you. But she's been in child welfare since 2005. We have been on quite the journey together throughout Megan's career. Many jobs, opened up a business, and since then, she's been working to become a trauma-informed care specialist and trainer. Now working on her master's at Indiana Wesleyan, and she is by far the most brilliant social work mind that I have ever met, and I've learned more about social work than I ever thought I would, but I'm excited to hear what she has to say, and it'll be good stuff. So, Megan Stroop.
You guys hear me? Okay. Well, thank you guys so much for being here tonight. It means so much that you're willing to give up an hour and a half of your time to come and hear about how we do better to protect kids and families. Protecting children is really all of our jobs, regardless of the title of our day job, whether it's stay-at-home mom, or I work at a bank, or car mechanic, judge, any of those, our job is all to make sure that we are protecting kids and families. A couple of housekeeping details that I wanted to go over before we really dig in here is, number one, the location of the restrooms. There is a restroom, male and female, back here, and then if you go back through the back door and down the stairs, there's also a restroom down there if you need that. I wanted to point out that you probably need to be aware that there's some graphic content in here. We're going to hear all sorts of really graphic things about child abuse and neglect. I'm not going to sugarcoat this for you because I don't think that that's the way to train this. I think that being really raw and honest about what child abuse and neglect looks like is the best way for you to learn. The other part of this is, we're actually going to hear briefly from a convicted sex abuser, and that is, it's a tough video to watch, but I can't imagine anybody telling you something that would open your eyes more than the words he's going to say in that short video. The other thing I will tell you is that there are some limits to this training. This will not answer every question that you have. Social work, child welfare is very situational. For example, when I worked at the Department of Child Services, we would get calls during the summer about families living in tents, and they don't have any running water, and our question would be, well, how do they take a bath? Well, they go to the campground, and they live in this tent, but then they take a bath, and they've got food. They're camping for the summer, and that's not a big deal during the summer. But we live in Indiana, and so come December, if they're still in a tent at the campground, that's a much different story. So some of the things we're going to talk about tonight might be seasonal. There might be just lots of different factors that change when a report is investigatable and when it is not. I would ask that you save the questions that you have to the end, or to when I break to ask for questions. The reason is because there's a lot of thought put into each slide, and so you may get your question asked or answered before you even have to ask it. If you have a specific question about a family member or friend, and this elicits some questions for you, I'm gonna stay after. If you have things you wanna talk to me specifically about, I'm willing to do that. But when sharing information to the group, please be respectful of people's private information. We don't wanna say, oh yeah, Sandy at the grocery store, well, I know that she does this with her kids, and you know, really could be sharing some private information. We want to be cautious about the things that we say in here. This training is really about being better safe than sorry. A couple of weeks ago, so really Labor Day weekend, all of you in here, I know pretty much every face and know that everybody in here lives in Grant County or works in Grant County, worships in Grant County, and that you know about the Skylee Carmack case. Skylee Carmack was a little girl who was reported missing. Our entire community banded together to find her. People were searching day and night, high and low for her. And ultimately, we didn't get the outcome that we wanted. She was found deceased and at the hands of her stepmother. It was that case that made me realize I could not take the knowledge that I have anymore and sit on it. I can't not tell people in Grant County about how to prevent child abuse and neglect, because I don't want that one more child. I don't want to know another child's name like that, and I'm sure you don't either. So I, in part of arranging this, we have a small little local news station here in the county, and it's called WMTV, and one of their reporters, her name is Ashley Lopez. I reached out to her just to ask if she would be willing to share on the news channel that I was doing this training and when the training was going to be, to get as much information or get the information out to as many people as possible. And she said, I'm so glad that you're doing this. I'm actually meeting with Skylee's parents this weekend, and I think they would love to hear what you're doing. So I had a few days and a few, like, oh gosh, you know, nerves to prepare for that. But I got to go into that meeting with Kevin Carmack, Skylee's father, and then her birth mother, and her name is Stacy. And they are grief-stricken, as I'm sure you can imagine. What really made me want to do this more than anything was watching a news report where I heard her father say, I wish I even knew what I was looking for. Everybody's asking me if I saw any signs, and I don't even know what I was supposed to be looking for. And then Skylee's grandmother said, I saw things that were concerning, and I wish I would have said something. And so this is about being better safe than sorry. Actually, during the meeting with Skylee's parents and Ashley Lopez and a couple of other community members, Ashley asked about creating a hashtag for this event just to help the marketing. It's kind of a Facebook algorithm thing for them. And we were sitting around trying to figure out a hashtag for it, and Stacy, Skylee's mother, came up with better safe than sorry. So just so you know where that hashtag comes from and how meaningful it is to this training, but also to the people that, unfortunately, their life story created a real need and a desire to be here tonight, probably for all of you and definitely for me. So, you're okay. I always think it's really important that people know what gives me the authority to speak on the topics that I'm talking about. Jake gave a little bit of my background with my history of being a social worker. I wanted to go a little bit deeper. So I have not only worked for the Department of Child Services, I've done assessments of safety for children, removed children from all sorts of situations, done ongoing case management to help families get the services that they need to have their children returned to them. I'm a certified trauma practitioner educator, which means that I am trained and approved to go into all sorts of different settings and train on trauma-informed care. I'm a forensic sexual abuse interviewer, a foster care trainer and curriculum writer. I'm a parent, which probably gives me more clout than anything, because I have been where so many of these parents have been, and then also an owner of a consulting company for trauma-informed care. And I do have a little one sheet back there if you would ever want to bring this training or any of the others that I do to your organization or, you know, anything from a ladies group to a business, a church, anything, I would be willing to come and do that. So that's a little bit about me. I think you're here because you realize that child abuse and neglect is a problem. But do you know how pervasive it is right here in our own county? So Grant County, we are ranked number one in Indiana for child poverty. Over the weekend, I actually participated in one of 50 conversations throughout our county over a 27-hour period to discuss the effects of poverty on kids and families. And we did that within 27 hours because 27% of kids in Indiana live underneath the poverty line. And as I'm sure you can imagine, not having enough food, not having enough resources, not having a house to live in or a space to call your own, that creates a lot of situations that lead to child abuse and neglect. Very stressful situations for parents. Sometimes even in, you know, just the neglect piece, the, you know, maybe sleeping in a tent during the summer, that could be a sign of having significant child poverty. So these two things, child abuse and neglect and child poverty, are very closely correlated. Next, we're ranked number two in the state for child food insecurity. Again, I can't tell you how many reports I've received throughout my years in the field of kids going to school and saying that they don't have enough food in their home. And we could give some fixes to that, you know, here's a food pantry or here's, you know, here's some canned goods, but it doesn't fix the long-term problem if we're not being intentional about fixing that. From a child abuse perspective, I think it's important to understand where we were when the numbers first started becoming available and then where we are now. So in about a 6.5-year period, we've seen an increase of child in need of services, and that is those children who have been removed by the Department of Child Services. And we've seen that rise from about 13,000 to 18,000. So that's a 28, almost 30% increase. In Grant County, we've had a 50% increase in the amount of CHINs. And then in Region 7, which encompasses Grant, Blackford, Jay, Randolph, Delaware, Wells, and Adams counties, 150% increase of children in the foster care system. As I'm sure you can imagine, this has crippled our foster care system. I'm sure you see the foster care things everywhere of, you know, be a foster parent and save a life, serve a child. They're doing that because there are simply not enough caregivers to go around. The opioid epidemic is part of that. When we see major substance abuse issues, so many other things just fall in line with that. So that's been a big part of it. And that information was accessed from indiana.gov, the DCS website. Specifically in July, substantiations, this is July of this year, so they substantiated 4 sexual abuse claims, 3 physical abuse, and 31 neglects. The reason why the neglects look so high and the other ones, I mean, even 4 children being sexually abused is a problem in my book, but the reason why you see such a drastic difference there is because Indiana counts everything except sexual and physical abuse as neglect. So substance exposure of an infant, drug exposure in the home, dirty home environment, life and health endangering, I mean, educational neglect, medical neglect, all of those are going to fall under that. So it's just a much wider, more broad category that those can fall in. There are really 4 different kinds of maltreatment: physical, sexual, and emotional abuse, as well as neglect. Physical abuse really can be classified as any non-accidental physical injury to a child. When a parent or caregiver commits an act that results in physical injury to a child, such as red marks, cuts, welts, bruises, muscle sprains, or broken bones, and the important thing to note here is that that is even if that injury was unintentional. So I've interviewed parents who've said, yes, I did spank my child. I didn't mean to leave a mark, but it did. And the reality is that it's the mark or bruise that allows DCS to substantiate physical abuse against a parent. Physical abuse comprises hitting, slapping, punching, kicking, shaking, choking, biting, and burning. It's tough to read some of those, to imagine that that happens to kiddos right here in our community, but it does. Physical abuse is probably the easiest type of abuse to see visually, and what most people think of when they hear abuse and neglect. They think of a kid with a busted lip or a, you know, some sort of physical injury that you can observe. There are some real signs to look for with physical abuse. So bruising, split lips, fractures, burns, head injuries. A big sign for us in the social work field is medical or dental problems that go untreated. So, you know, a kid falls and has an injury that looks pretty serious and it, like, doesn't get taken to the doctor. And then the other part of that is unexplained injuries or in areas that don't make sense for the age of the child. So to go forward with that, to explain that a little bit further, a Riley Hospital physician came up with the term no cruising equals no bruising. So if you really think about like a 3 or 4 month old baby, they're not going anywhere. They shouldn't have a bruise on their forehead. They shouldn't have a bruise anywhere on their body. And if they do, that's a little suspicious. And you want to, you know, you might ask the parent, well, what happened there? How did that, you know, I had children 363 days apart. I'm sure that my daughter gave Eli bruises. If I could remember it, I slept as very little as I, knowing how little I slept, I can't remember much of that time period. I think I just kind of blocked it all out. But a child in a home with no other children that has bruising, that should raise some red flags for us. Another thing is bruises are more suspicious in locations where there is no bony prominence underneath. So if I fall and hit my cheek or hit my forehead, there's bone there. Like, that makes sense that a big bruise would happen. Right here in my cheeks, on my arms, around my eyes, my abdomen, my bottom, soft area, or neck, ears, I would see a lot of slap marks, like to catch a baby and it would get their ear. And so you'd see bruising on the ears. Especially in premobile children, injuries to the frenulum are also suspicious. So frenulum is that little piece of skin that connects your top lip to your gum, and then down here and then under your tongue as well. Sometimes we would see babies with injuries to the frenulum where bottles are being shoved in their mouth because they were screaming. And so that's something that we were always trained to look for. Just kind of something to think about. Any questions about child physical abuse, specifically what it looks like or anything like that? Okay, let's move on. I'll tell you, we're moving into child sexual abuse. I know this is a tough topic, but I think it's important to talk about. So child sexual abuse happens when adults or older children engage children in any kind of sexual activity. The number one report that I received, other than neglect, but the number one sexual report that I received was, we called it kid on kid. So one child to another child. Often it had a lot to do with lack of supervision of parents or, kids run off and go play in this room or whatever and nobody's really paying attention, and so then things can happen. In Hamilton County, when I worked there, it was reported all the time. In Grant County, it seemed not as big of a problem, and I would say it probably happens with the same amount of frequency, but people are less likely to report it here. So child sexual abuse is everything from intercourse, oral sex, on the child, having the child perform oral sex on them, touching child's private parts, asking the child to touch the other person's private parts, asking to see a child's private parts, and then making the child look at another person's private parts. Sexual activities that may be less obvious but are still abusive to children include showing pornography to children, taking pornographic photos of children, sexting or sending sexually explicit texts with children, and then commercial sexual exploitation of children, such as using them as prostitutes or sex trafficking in some way. Actually, the sexting problem has gotten so out of hand that we're seeing a lot of communities around the state and other states that are charging teenagers with sending their own nude photos out when it's discovered by schools. And so then you have 15, 16, 17-year-old girls and boys who are being charged as sex offenders because they are breaking a law when they do that. So most teenagers don't know that, but something that is very serious and could cause major issues for them as adults. Signs of sexual abuse. This is tough. I'm gonna give you some physical, behavioral, and emotional signs of it. But the reality is that in most cases, there is no physical evidence whatsoever in sexual abuse. Almost none. How sexual abuse is sometimes discovered is a child might develop a sexually transmitted infection. Signs of trauma to the genital area, such as unexplained bleeding, bruising, or maybe even blood on the sheets. Again, that is incredibly rare. Do not count on that as being what you're looking for, because it is so, so, so rare. Frequent stomach aches. And this kind of goes across the board, that when kids are having a tough time, they don't say, you know, my cousin is doing this to me. They say, my belly hurts, I don't feel good. And so when you're having somebody who seems to be okay, but then all of a sudden their belly is hurting all the time and it's kind of unexplained and you don't know what's going on and there's really no medical reason for it, just ask some questions. And then pain or itching in the genital area, which could be signs of that, of an STI or an STD. Behavioral signs. Sexual behavior that's inappropriate for the child's age. So we would often see, we would get a report from a preschool of, these children are playing with this toy in a really bizarre way. They're making this comment that's really bizarre and seems outside of what they should know about. Some parents see things like bedwetting, fearful of being left alone with certain people, and then trying to avoid removing clothing to change or bathe, especially in front of someone else. Emotional signs, excessive worry or fearfulness, nightmares, fear of being alone at night, or excessive talk or knowledge of sexual topics. Something I want to say that I think even still most people do not realize, checking the hymen on a female is not a way to determine sexual activity. That used to be how that was determined. And you know, the child would go to the doctor if that was intact, okay, nothing happened. Well, what we know now is that sexual abuse is so much more than just penetration. And even if there is penetration, that may not have been what caused that hymen to break. And so we don't want to wrongly assume that sexual abuse is happening when maybe it isn't. The other thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that 93% of child sexual assault victims know their perpetrator. This does not happen generally by somebody who looks creepy that you don't know jumping out of a bush or out of a white van and snatching a kid. We hear about that on the news because it's newsworthy. That isn't how this usually happens. What we don't hear about often is the cousin who molests a child for 15 years, or the uncle, or the scout leader, or something like that. They know their perpetrator. the reported numbers of child sexual abuse is that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 20 boys report being sexually abused by age 18. Now, I'm a social worker. I'm not good at math. And if you know me, you know that to be true. But there's a lot more than 4 girls in this room. And so just knowing that, how many of us could be sitting in this room right now knowing that this is either part of our history or part of the history of someone that we know and love and care for. The highest percentage of our sexual abuse victims are under the age of 9. The other part of the tough reality of child sexual assault is that because these victims often know their perpetrator and have been groomed, and we're gonna watch a video about grooming here in just a moment, but because they know this perpetrator, these kids are less likely to tell, and they're also less likely to be believed. Because, oh, Bill wouldn't do that. Oh my gosh, he's such a nice guy. No, that would never happen. And it just makes it a little bit more difficult for that child. Somebody jumps out of a bush and there's a crazy fast like sexual encounter, most people are pretty likely to go to the police and report that. That's totally outside of what's normal for them. When they've been groomed, it doesn't feel abnormal to them. Here, we're gonna watch this video of Jack Reynolds. He is a convicted child predator as he describes how he groomed young boys before molesting them.
Grooming. I would check out their family situation. I would check out their clothing to see how well they were, you know, financially. I would check out their social interaction with other kids. You know, when we were on the ballparks or on the gym floor, you know, I would make sure which ones I wanted to molest. I would give them special attention, congratulate them, talk to them when I know that I would never be allowed to talk to anybody else, you know, aside from everybody. I would give them the attention that an official is not supposed to give anybody. And it made them feel like, wow, he's paying me attention. You know, it is a direct form of grooming.
Were there certain characteristics that you look for in children before molesting them?
In children, yes, but more I also looked at their families. If I thought the father was a threat, I would not approach the child. If I thought that the child had friends that he would tell, I would not approach him. If I thought the child had friends that were in the same capacity he was, I would approach him. For the simple fact that if I could molest him, I could lure him into believing, grooming him into believing that he would enjoy it. And therefore, I can manipulate him into having his other friends come and be molested by me as well.
So perhaps a child that doesn't really have a whole lot of friends, maybe not really a strong family, things like that.
Yes, no spiritual values, weak in education, you know, needs help in many ways. Even from split parenting, you know, has a mother who may be having problems with the family, you know, well, here comes superhero in to help out, you know, wow, well, thank you very much. No problem. You ever need me to take him away for the night so you can have a night out? No problem. It works.
Pretty freaky, huh? I mean, I wondered how people would respond to that video, but I said, I can't say it better than that. I can't be that creepy, I hope. But a lot of what he said there goes back to what we know about neglect. Not great home settings, single parents, and that's not in any way a dig against single parents, but just that there's less support there. Not great friends, parents not involved, those sort of things. All of this we're going to see show up in neglect later on. So these are all so interrelated. If a child is, we substantiate one thing on them, most likely you could find evidence to substantiate more than one thing, generally. When the system is broken, it's usually not just broken in one area. So following that, I wanted to give you a couple of ways to keep your kids safe. Teach them the correct words for their private body parts. Breasts, nipples, vagina, penis should be as well known as ears and elbows. My sister-in-law knows that that's what my kids say, and she just told me this weekend, it's so weird to hear Eli say penis. And I'm like, I get that. However, I've been in way too many interviews where they're not using the right terms and they're awkward about saying it, and I would much rather Eli come in there and be bold and brave and know that only he gets to touch his penis, then have it be any other way. So we're pretty clear about that in our house. Kids need to feel it's natural and not embarrassing to use those correct words. Another way to keep your children or children that you know safe, teach them safety rules for their body, much like you would, you know, hey, when your ball goes out into the road, you stop. You don't go out and run after it. You don't answer the door for a stranger. If somebody knocks on the door, you wait until mommy or daddy are there to answer it. These are just rules that you have in your home to keep kids safe. So not touching someone else's private body parts, not asking or not okay for someone to ask you to touch their private body parts, not okay for someone to take videos or photos of you with your clothes off, all of these kind of things. The other thing, it's important that kids understand that it's okay to tell adults no. We raise kids to be compliant, and that's great when they're being compliant to people who are trustworthy. But it is totally okay to tell kids to say no to adults when the situation is right. Also, if any of these things ever happen, tell them to tell an adult. Make sure that they understand that you're a safe person they can come to. A way to handle this would be to establish an always ask first rule. So your child should always ask either you or the adult in charge before anyone can give them food, give them a gift, take them somewhere, or do something with them. Again, going back to that hashtag, better safe than sorry. Teach your child the difference between surprises and secrets. That was something that I heard a lot in the field was, well, we had this secret, or we were going to surprise mommy with this. We had this secret from mommy. Well, a surprise is something that is exciting because everybody's going to know what it is eventually. Right? A surprise party, we're all going to be there, so we're going to keep it a secret from mommy for a week until the party's here, and then it's like, yay, this is a really good thing. Secrets go on, and that's not a surprise, and it's important to make that difference for them. Next, choose alternate caregivers and dating partners wisely. Some ways to do that, make surprise visits when you have a caregiver caring for your child. Ask your child what happens with the caregiver. If they say they don't like them, ask for reasons. It could be as simple as, well, they don't give me cookies when I want cookies. or it could be something much more nefarious. Be cautious about leaving your child with someone they don't feel comfortable with. You know your children. You know if there's something off there. Pay attention to that. Our guts as parents are so important. If your child is nonverbal, again, same thing. Pay attention to body language that might suggest that they're scared or uncomfortable with someone. Also, I hear this all the time. Well, I background check everybody that my kids hang out with. Well, good for you. A background check tells you what they've been caught for in the past. It does not tell you anything except what they've been caught for in the past. And that's not to say that we shouldn't background check for positions like church ministry or schools. That's important information to have, but we can't make all of our decisions based on a background check. So just be aware of that. We're going to watch a quick little video of some parents talking to their kids about sexual abuse and normalizing that. I think it's just a really good video to see it in action, so you know how that might look at your house. Oh, I already said that.
Next on Live at 5, man charged with sexual abuse of his 6-year-old niece.
I hate this. I can't watch this anymore.
It's crazy. How are we ever going to let Brianna be alone with anyone?
To help protect kids from sexual abuse, talk with them about it in ways they'll understand, even if it's awkward.
So...
Okay.
It's like this.
It's about... We have to talk about people who...
Try to...
If anyone...
Ever tries to, you know,
touch your...
Private...
Parts.
Totally messing this up. Why?
It's just like talking to kids about safety rules. You need to talk about it a lot.
Kevin? I love that head. Put a helmet on it.
Mom.
To help kids stay safe from sexual abuse, you need to talk about it a lot, too. Tell kids, always ask me first.
Listen, we all know Coach Al, but you still have to ask me first before you get in his car.
But it's Coach.
Doesn't matter. You have to ask me first, okay?
Got it.
Tell kids. Tell me if anyone tries to touch your private parts.
Kevin, before you go out, okay, this is a little weird, but if anyone ever tries to touch your private parts...
Mom, do we really have to talk about this?
We really do. And you have to tell me if it ever happens, okay?
Weird, but I will.
Tell kids no secrets.
Sweetheart, nobody can touch your private parts, okay? Remember? No secrets if anyone tries. Okay?
Okay, Daddy.
All right.
Keep talking about sexual abuse and keep asking questions.
Have a good time?
Yeah.
What'd you do?
Well...
The more you ask, listen, and talk, the easier it gets.
What I'm trying to say, honey, is that it's not okay for anyone to ever touch you there. Hey, your private parts. Okay?
Okay, Mommy.
I can do this.
To help keep kids safe from sexual abuse, tell kids, always ask me first. Nobody can touch your private parts. No secrets. Tell kids, tell me.
So my daughter is here tonight, and I'm sure that she would tell you that we have conversations like that often. She said to me, one time we were driving down the road and she said, "Oh, Mom, do you see that white van? It's so creepy." And I said, "Why do you think that white van's creepy?" And she said, "Oh, I mean, it's like they could jump out of it at the grocery store and just grab you." And I said, "That's usually not what happens." And so we had this whole conversation about grooming and what that looks like. And I'm sure there was a bit of her that was a little horrified and a little embarrassed that we were having this conversation, and probably more so now that I'm calling it out. But the more you have those conversations and are upfront and honest with your kids, the easier it gets. And I'll tell you, I mean, I have gone through training after training. I'm a forensic sexual abuse interviewer, and it's not easy to have some of these conversations. The first time Kately asked me the whole, like, I was pregnant for Emily, and they're 5 years apart. And Emily, or Kately, said, "So how is baby Emily going to get out of your body?" And I was like, "Well, there's this thing called a C-section, And that's what usually happens. And described this surgery where they were, and I mean, it was a really graphic description, but I was like, she's never going to ask that question again. And, you know, since then we've talked about what really happens. But I was not prepared, and I have lots of training. So if this feels awkward and weird, like, it will, and that's okay. So any questions about sexual abuse before I move on? All right, let's move on to emotional abuse. So this one is actually the most difficult to see or to quantify. Often, it makes people feel uncomfortable and has them doubt if they could report it because there's no, like, no abuse has really happened. So there's nothing that they can see. Emotional abuse is everything from humiliating or constantly criticizing a child, pushing a child too hard, exposing a child to upsetting events or situations like domestic violence or taking drugs, substance abuse, persistently ignoring kids, being absent from them, never saying anything kind, and then never showing emotions, which would also be known as emotional neglect. So when there's just parents really aren't there, they're kind of absent. Signs of emotional abuse. As children grow up, we know that their emotions change, so it can be difficult to tell if they're being emotionally abused, but kids who might be facing this might seem really unconfident or lack self-assurance of any kind. They might struggle to control their emotions, act in ways that are inappropriate for their age, and then have difficulty creating or maintaining relationships. Signs in babies and toddlers: be overly affectionate to strangers or people they don't know very well. When I worked in the field doing investigations, I can't tell you how many times I would walk into a home and sit down on the couch and start talking with a parent, and their little child would crawl up on my lap and be hugging my neck and kissing my cheek, and it was like, oh, this kid's so cute. But that's not normal. That's really unusual for a child that you don't know at all to do that. And so it wasn't anything that I was like, well, this kid's coming with me today. Obviously, they need to be protected. But it was definitely something where I just kind of put a pin in that. Like, I'm going to give that a little bit of a red flag, remember that, and pay attention to what else is going on. Kids who are really aggressive or cruel towards other children or animals, and then children who seem not to have any sort of bond with their parent or caregiver. Signs in older children: lacking social skills, extreme outburst, using language you wouldn't expect them to for their age, social isolation, and struggling to control their emotions. Any questions about emotional abuse? Okay. And then last is neglect. So neglect is the ongoing failure to meet a child's basic needs and really the most common form of abuse. Neglect can be a lot of different things, but broadly speaking, there's about four different types. So physical neglect: this is when a child's basic needs are not being met. Educational neglect is when the parent doesn't ensure that their child is given an education. I think that we're going to hear a lot of commentary on educational neglect following Skylie's case. And the reason I say that is because she was homeschooled. And while that in and of itself isn't a problem, in Indiana, you have to have no proof that you're doing homeschooling, and you have to have no curriculum or anything. There's nothing done. So I think that as this case has come to light, and there's been some realization there from community members that there's really no expectations of that, I think that we're going to see some advocacy here locally regarding that particular area. emotional neglect, so when the child doesn't get the nurturing and stimulation that they need. And then medical neglect is when a child isn't given proper health care. So includes dental care and refusing or ignoring medical recommendations. Something that we would get called in for would be AMA. So Emma, do you know what that means yet? AMA? No. Emma just started college for nursing about 5 minutes ago. So it means against medical advice. So if a child would go to the doctor and doctor starts asking some questions, parents say, we're leaving, the doctor would often call and say, this parent left our office AMA, or against medical advice. We would follow up with that parent. Sometimes they followed up with appropriate health care that they just didn't like that particular doctor, and that was perfectly fine. That was a good open and shut case. But then other times, it was more serious than that and needed DCS to be involved. Some signs of neglect. Again, this is a pretty long list because there's so much that can be covered. Poor hygiene, and I don't mean like the stinky teenage boy hygiene. Like, we all know I have a 4-year-old boy and he's gross. So we know it's a little deeper than that for a teenage boy. Always seeming hungry. Inappropriate clothing for the season. So I always think of the movie The Blind Side when he's walking around and has two t-shirts and is wearing a pair of shorts and it's freezing cold outside. That was a sign of neglect. Untreated medical or dental issues, unstable living conditions, poor language skills, and generally where the poor language skills comes in is that often there's not a lot of relationship between child and parent that's creating a neglect type of situation. If children are taking on caregiving role for other family members, so in the field we call that being parentified, you'll often see the oldest female, even if she's not the oldest child, but the oldest female taking that role where she's parentified and caring for the other children in the home. Missing lots of school, difficulty concentrating at school, and then weight or growth issues. The important thing to remember about all of the signs and symptoms that I've given you tonight is that there's not one of, I mean, with the exception of physical abuse, that is pretty clear cut. You know, they've got a punch to the eye and say, Mom did this to me. That's pretty clear. But the rest of these could be a sign of many other things. Our 5-year-old, she had a speech delay, so she had poor language skills. We did everything that we could do. We were in speech therapy 4 days a week. But, you know, if you just looked at that in a vacuum, you would say, well, maybe she's neglected. There's a lot more to that story there. And so all of these things have to be taken into consideration with the others surrounding them. It's the totality of a situation, not just one thing, typically. Here's how to report child abuse and neglect. I've given you these numbers. Also, there are magnets in the back that have those numbers for you. I wanted to share this information, or wanted you to have these numbers, and wanted you to be able to take something home and slap it on your fridge. Take a couple if you want to. I went to Prevent Child Abuse of Grant County to one of their meetings and shared that I wanted to do this, kind of like a poison control sticker. Like we used to get the green yuck stickers and stuff. I'm probably age dating myself there a little bit, but I wanted this to be like that. And Crime Stoppers was there and said, how much did you say it was again? And I told him and he said, oh, we'll get it. So Crime Stoppers sponsored those magnets for you guys to be able to take home today. With regards to reporting child abuse, a couple of questions that I get asked a lot. Who can report child abuse or neglect? Everyone. Everyone in this room. In fact, in Indiana, every single person, every one of us in this room, is a mandated reporter, meaning that you are required to report knowledge or even suspicion of child abuse. You don't have to prove the abuse is happening. The proper authorities will do that, but you do have to call. Due to this law, reporting abuse to a school principal or an alleged perpetrator's family does not meet your legal obligation. If you think that child abuse or neglect is happening next door to you, down the road, in a child whose classroom you work, you are required to call DCS yourself or law enforcement and make that call. Can I report anonymously? That's another question that I get a lot. Thank you. I don't know what I was doing there. Yes, you can report anonymously. If you make a report with knowledge that only you would have, the family could guess that it's you who reported it, but DCS will never confirm this information. It is totally illegal for them to do that. That is honestly the first thing that DCS workers learn before pretty much anything else. So that's drilled in their brains pretty well. The other thing, well, I'll go on to the next one. It'll fit better there. What will I need to provide when making a report? So the intake specialist would ask you for information, but really it's kind of like if you were writing a news article, the who, what, where, when, and how kind of questions. Who was involved, what occurred, when did it happen, where did it happen, the extent of any injuries received, and other information. Even if you don't have all of the information above, it's still okay to make that call and allow DCS to determine if they have enough information to move forward with initiating an assessment of child safety or not. The good news is we all get to be lay people because we don't work at DCS. And when they get the report, it's them. It's on them now. They have to go and do the work. They've got to get the information and really dig down. And so it relieves us of those responsibilities after we've made that report. The other question I get all the time, in fact, I just got an email today saying, I have a concern, should I make a report about this or not? Or will DCS even do anything? And without even hearing a thing about it, my answer is always, well, yes, make the report. It's not up to us to decide. That's not our job. It's DCS and law enforcement's job to decide that. It's our job to do the best that we can do. Any questions about the reporting process or what that would look like for anyone in here? Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can handle that a couple of different ways. What I would say is that that would be a little bit more of an emergent situation than a DCS call. So DCS has anywhere from a 1 hour to a 5 day response time, depending on the allegation that's made. So in that situation, you're looking at this family at dinner and you're going, there is something really amiss here. You might do a little bit of recon and sneak out and see if you can get their license plate number. Don't get yourself hurt or in anything by doing that. Or you could just call the police, go into the bathroom or go out to your car, call the police and ask them to come and have a conversation with the family. And that would be an immediate response because 911 is an immediate response. They don't have, you know, we'll get to that in 5 days. So, it's just kind of a different time frame expectation. Yeah. I get that question a lot about, I watched this kid get walloped in Walmart, and what do I do? So, yeah. Did you have one in the back? No? Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably similar to what you see in children. Adults are a little bit better at compartmentalizing generally. So here's the face I'm going to show with this group. Here's the face I'm going to show with this group. So even adults that you are close with, you may not get the full extent of their situation. The best thing you can do in any sort of concern of abusive situation, domestic violence, workplace violence, anything like that, is to build a relationship with that individual to where they trust you, to be able to ask the questions that you can to help keep them safe, and then follow through on your word to, if that's, I want to help you report this to the appropriate authorities or whatever. And the other part of this is that adults have self-determination and kids don't. So when in Indiana, you could report that domestic violence was happening and the police could show up to someone's house and they say, nope, nothing's going on here. And the police don't have a right to enter. If you say, I believe that there's abuse happening in this house, they may have to go and get a subpoena to do it, but DCS and law enforcement can ensure safety of that child in one way or another. So a little bit of a different situation there. Did that answer totally? Okay, anything else? This is a great video. It's The Power of One Caring Adult, and I show this in a lot of my trainings because I think it's important that you know how vital you are to the success of children, and may even just be one kid and you're that one adult in their life. But I want you to take a quick look at this. Oh, I'm skipping ahead of myself. We'll get to that video in just a minute. My printer wouldn't work to do the rest of my slides. How to help families in need. So you can help families in need in a variety of ways. And I kind of like for people to remember that families in need are going to demonstrate that in a multitude of different ways. And so we can come alongside them, hopefully before their children are removed. That's the goal of this, is not just to go, oh, I see some signs. There's a perpetrator of child abuse or neglect. Let's get them. I'm not trying to flood the child welfare system here in Grant County by providing this information. What I'm trying to do here is help you guys see signs that maybe they could use some more intervention, and maybe that intervention would be enough to just have you intervene with them. So if you can create a supportive relationship, we know that change happens through relationship. Consider providing support to a foster or relative placement or even a biological family who seems to be struggling by bringing a meal to them, offering free childcare, maybe mow their lawn, or ask them how they need to be prayed for. You could donate gently used or new items to a family in need, again, a foster family, biological family. And then I get a lot of questions about, but what else can I do? So consider volunteering to become a CASA. Our CASA programs in Grant and Madison counties are very, very active, and the directors of those programs are incredible women. A CASA is a court-appointed special advocate. So that's someone who receives training, and their job is to meet with children who are involved in the child welfare system, or involved in the court system in some way, and speak in court on the behalf of that child. So you are the child's voice. If you're interested in short-term care of children, where you really want to work with birth families and help them get their lives back intact, Safe Families is something that's recently come to Grant County. They've been in Madison County for a little while, so I could make some referrals to the appropriate ladies who handle both of those programs. If you're interested in long-term care of children, consider foster care. I know we've got a couple of foster parents in this room, or past foster parents, and then adoptive parents. And then if you're looking to keep a child forever, you have a few options, including private domestic infant adoption, and I could make some referrals on, if you wanted to go that route, some great adoption agencies, out-of-country adoptions, or adoptions through DCS. Children are adopted through DCS all the time because they're parental rights have been terminated. And actually, if you go on the DCS website, you can look on there, and there's at any time about 150 or more kids waiting for homes that their parental rights have been completely terminated, and so they are living as orphans. And they're typically in foster homes or residential settings or something like that, getting the care that they need. So they're not just sleeping at a DCS office, but they do need a family to commit to them. And last but not least, we want to pray over these situations always. So please keep this in your mind as you go home and you process what we talked about tonight. Include, you know, birth families in your prayers. Include all of the situations that we just don't know what is going on there. The other thing that I would say is a lot of people, and when I first started in child welfare, I really thought, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna help keep kids safe. I'm gonna remove them from the people who are abusing them, and I'm gonna keep kids safe. And the longer I was in the field, what I saw is that the parents of the children in the field, or in child welfare, are age-progressed children who they themselves have been abused or neglected. And rather than wanting to remove their children, I just wished that I could provide them parents. And I couldn't figure out how to do that. I still don't know how to do that. But it was easier for me when I started to realize that these parents who, you know, are committing some form of child abuse and neglect, they're often, their story is one that would not make you mad if you heard it, but it would absolutely rip your heart out. A situation I can think of, several years ago, I actually left DCS and went to work for a private adoption agency for a few years. And then I came back, I did that for about 9 months and then went back to DCS. When I came back, I was visibly pregnant with Emily, our middle child. I was about 6 months pregnant. And my first case was a woman who was a young parent. Two of her children were already placed in foster care, and then she had a third child who was home with her. Judges in Indiana differ on how they understand the law. And so one judge may say, for an afterborn or a child that's born when there's an open case, one judge might say, well, the law is clear that abuse and neglect must occur to this child before we can remove them from their home. Another judge might say, if these children aren't safe, there's no way I can put a newborn baby there. And both, there's a judge in the room, or a previous judge, I should consult him about that at some point and see what his philosophy on that was. But our judge at that time sided with the fact that if abuse or neglect had not yet occurred to that infant, that we could not remove that infant until something happened. So this is my first week back on the job, being in Grant County, and we got a domestic violence call on this mom. Baby's about 3 months old. I show up to the house and realize that, yes, domestic violence did happen. There's evidence on mom. The house is a mess. It looks like they've just had an all-out brawl in here. And through this conversation with her, I end up telling her that I'm really sorry. I have to remove your child today. She ends up in a blur of obscenities, tells me that she wishes, or that she hopes, that my effing baby dies, the one I'm visibly pregnant with. And my first thought was, oh, like, she is obviously Satan reincarnated. What piece of crap says that to another human? She's a terrible person. And I really did not like her. I couldn't believe, no matter what I was doing to you, how could you ever say that to me? Well, I got to know her, worked with her for about almost 2 years, actually. And in the time that I got to know her, I got to hear her story. And this mother's story was that she was about 3 years old. She was removed from her biological family for some combination of abuse and neglect. She was placed in foster care with a foster family that was not a pre-adoptive family. So she did her visits with her parents. Ultimately, it was determined that her parental rights would be terminated and that she would be freed up for adoption. So about the age of 6 years old, she was then transitioned to a third home, which was her adoptive home. And this adoptive home consisted of a mom and a dad and a brother and a sister. And they seemed like just such a really great family. And everybody was so excited. They had good income. Mom was a stay-at-home mom, so she could meet this child's needs. There's just one little flaw. The sister's name was this child's first name. So they just changed her name so that she could go to the house, because it would look really weird if you had an adopted child and both of your girls were named the same name. Tough to explain. So now she, at 6 years old, is on her third home. They've just changed her first name, and she starts acting out and having what we call as behaviors. And of course she does. I would start to have behaviors if you changed my name at six, and I'd been in three homes. And so she starts to act out. This goes on for a couple years. Dad finally comes to mom and asks for either the child goes or I go. Mom says something along the lines of, you know, we've adopted her. She's here to stay. Ultimately, mom and dad get a divorce. Through that, dad says, I only want to do visits with my child or with my children. She is not my child. So kids are going to dad's house on the weekends, coming home, and they're saying things to her like, our parents would still be married if not for you. You've ruined our family. I mean, absolutely horrifying things. And we're just adding to the layers of the onion of trauma that are making up this child's life. Fast forward a few more years, the behaviors continue, they get worse. Mom doesn't get a break because now she's a single parent, and you know, all of these different things. Her siblings hate her. And mom shows up at a DCS office and says, I'm really sorry, I can't do this anymore, you've got to take her back. In the social work world, we call this a return to sender child, where they're brought back into the office, and it's sad that we have a name for that, but it happens more than you'd think. And so she said, I can't do this. My husband left me, my kids hate me. I thought I was doing the right thing by bringing her into our home, and she's done nothing but wreck it. And at that time, DCS did what they did and placed her in a residential setting. She was about 12 years old. She aged out of the residential setting at 18, never was adopted again, never had another shot at a family. And that was her story. By the time I got to her, she was 22 years old, so just a short few years away from that experience of being in residential care. Had domestic violence with every relationship she'd been in since getting out of the residential treatment center, had no parents and no direction to help guide her, and had two of her children already removed from the very system that failed her. She hated my guts and every single thing that I represented. Was it right for her to say that she wished that my child would die? Absolutely not. But when I understood her story, I had a lot more compassion for her. I actually sat with this very brave woman while she signed over her parental rights for her two oldest children. She said, they've been gone from my care for so long. I know that they're loved by this family, and I want to give them that. She fought hard, and she brought her baby home. When I asked her, because she would show up to visits for her youngest child, and she would not show up to visits for her oldest children, and I finally said to her one day, why don't you come? And she said, well, they can tell when I'm high, and she can't. So I had written court report after court report judging this mom for not showing up to visit. She's non-compliant. She's not interested in getting her children home. No effort being made. and she was protecting them. I didn't understand it. It wasn't the way that I imagined I would protect in that situation, but it was what she could do. And that case really forever changed the way that I practice and changed how I looked at parents and really caused me to want to dig down what happened, what created the situation. People do not wake up in the morning and decide to just abuse or kill their child. They don't wake up and decide to just use meth because YOLO, it's Tuesday. That's not how this works. There is so much of a breakdown by the time they get to this point that it takes us to intervene before they get there. Like I said, this video is one that I absolutely love, and it's so good to just show you how important you are in the lives of those kids and even those age-progressed children that masquerade as adults but aren't because they don't have the emotional capacity yet because no one showed them how to love or how to care. This is what I hope you're called to do. Also, the Community Foundation just released a comprehensive resource guide, so you're welcome to go there. They've got all sorts of resources in case someone needs that.
I tried to kill myself with a bottle of pills. And the fact of the matter is, I trusted no one. And looking back, I guess, how could I? From the time my parents left me, to the time another foster kid raped me, to the time I was bullied so bad, I genuinely could not fathom a world where I could trust anybody. So fast forward, here I am, 14 years old, and entering my umpteenth foster home. I was a pro, a veteran at this whole sort of getting kicked out of one home, moved to the next. You meet these people who were like literally complete and total strangers 10 minutes ago who are now apparently your mom and dad. You know, kids don't take candy from strangers, just move in with them. So I'm sitting in the van in the driveway of this next home, and that's when I see Rodney. He's standing up there on the front porch, and immediately I notice this is a large fella. He's 6'5", he's 350 pounds, and as a 14-year-old boy, I couldn't help but notice, when he's turned to the side like that, he's shaped like a lowercase b. It's amusing now, but in the moment, it was tactical. Maybe that's how I could get kicked out of this home. Maybe I could get under his skin about his weight. So I move in with him. I'm being obnoxious, I'm being ungrateful, I'm being just downright rude and mean, I'm setting things on fire, and 3 years later, I can't shake this guy. Rodney won't kick me out. So I step up my game. I go to the local bank in town, I open up a checking account. I put about 90 bucks in there. Then I proceed to write $10,000 worth of checks. Obviously, checks bouncing one after the next after the next. One check that bounced was for my car insurance. I'm going down the road speeding, Stillwater, Oklahoma, 88 miles an hour. No car insurance, no driver's license. I get pulled over, handcuffed, thrown in the back of a cop car, and sent to jail. I call Rodney. Like, Rodney, I'm in Stillwater, I'm in jail. I'll tell you the whole thing when you get here. Can you please come bail me out tonight? He said, I will come bail you out, but not till tomorrow. Rodney frustratingly believed sometimes one of the most loving things you could do for a kid was allow them to sit in either the success of their wonderful choice or the stupidity of their foolish choice. Next morning, he comes, bells me out, exactly as promised. We have a long, very awkward car ride home. No one says anything. We get back to the house. He's like, we need to sit down and talk. And I knew this moment had finally come. So Rodney, his wife, sent me down to give me the talk I've had a dozen times. He looks in my eyes and says, son, you can keep causing problems. You can keep trying to mess up. You can keep pushing us away. You can keep trying to get us to kick you out of here, but you've got to get it through your thick head, son. We don't see you as a problem. We see you as an opportunity. And in that moment, all my skepticism came to the surface. And I thought, what a cheesy, stupid thing to say to a 17-year-old kid. But then I was overwhelmed with the reality that this guy actually meant it. He didn't see what I was on the surface. the obnoxious kid, the ungrateful kid, the kid getting suspended. He saw what I could be. It was genuinely my turning point. Statistically, I am supposed to be dead, in jail, or homeless. But because of one caring adult. I'm not a statistic. Every kid is one caring adult away from being a success story. Every child who winds up doing well has had at least one stable and committed relationship with a supportive adult. My friend and mentor, Reggie Joyner, taught me to think about it this way. In this jar are 936 marbles. Each one of these marbles represents a single week from the birth of a kid until that kid turns 18 years old. So if you know a 9-year-old, you've only got 468 marbles, or weeks, however you want to look at it, remaining. You know a 16-year-old? You got 104 marbles remaining. Right here, we are looking at time. In fact, you're looking at all the time or all of the weeks you have left to influence this kid, or this kid, before they turn 18 and begin making critical life decisions without your presence. The difference between a statistic and a success story is you.
So that concludes tonight. Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate that you've given me this time, and I hope that you learned some things and took away some knowledge. Please remember, for Skyly, we're going to be better safe than sorry in Grant County. This next slide I'll play as you leave. This is my favorite song. It is Be One by Natalie Grant. It is the reason that Be Love is tattooed on my wrist, because this is the anthem for my life. Be Love, there's a whole lot of hurting. I think that's what tonight's about. That's what I live my life for. And I think that's the same for many of you. So enjoy. I will be back in the back here in just a moment to talk to you if you have any questions.
So we're so glad you were with us today. You can subscribe on iTunes or Spotify or your preferred podcasting app. Be sure to rate us so other people can know about the podcast.